You've heard of Grammarly, and you might think it's a fancy spell check, but people on your team have been using it and loving it for years, because it does way more than you realise. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that works seamlessly across apps and websites and can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, companies can save 19 days per employee per year. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
I'm Caroline Hyde at Bloomberg's World Headquarters in New York.
And I'm Ed Ludlow in San Francisco. This is Bloomberg Technology.
Coming up in the next hour, Sam Bankman-Fried says he's willing to testify before the US House Financial Services Committee about the collapse of his crypto empire. We'll tell you what to expect from next week's hearing.
Plus, Huawei strikes a deal to license tech to a handset rival, a bitter pill to swallow for the Chinese tech giant that's blocked from selling its tech in the US. We speak to two of their key executives.
And we continue our coverage of China's risk to dropping its COVID zero stance, plus changes to Tesla's Shanghai factory amid slowing consumer demand. We have you covered. First, though, foremost, it is a markets day for us, of course. We are once again seeing the wind taken out of the sails of equities. We're seeing up down 0.75%. So exhausting that this camera is getting all overexcited by what's happening in these markets. Come closer. No, back off. We're having a look at the Nasdaq off by 0.7%. Look, these benchmarks are off by at least 3.5-4% on the week overall, Ed. And this, in large part, is because we're worrying about where the Federal Reserve is going. We're concerned, for example, about how far they have to hike when we're seeing a PPI, a producer price index, that shows that prices are just showing such resilience, inflation showing such resilience in the face of what have been rapid rate hikes by the Fed. 10-year yields have been climbing almost 10 basis points. Let's have a look at what's happening overall in terms of our recession risks, as we are anticipating the worry about a recession. We are seeing the entire market just getting nervous. If we can flip up the board, we've really got this chart that has evidence of where we've been going in terms of the pickup. Now 60% chance, basically, the market sees there will be in a recession, so a contraction in this economy in the US come next year. And we just got to keep talking about this contagion effect, keep talking about what happens next week, what clarity we get, if any, because we know that the former FTX CEO, Ed Sam Bankman-Fried, says he is actually willing to testify. How did he tell us? Of course, he told us through Twitter. He announced it in a series of tweets, in fact, saying he will answer questions about the fall of his crypto empire from the U.S. House Financial Services Committee. Let's bring in Alison Versprill from Washington, who has been all across this story. And, of course, so too has our own Shanali Basak, who, of course, will be heading out to Washington to that hearing next week. And, Alison, just what did you make of the transparency we're getting through the former Twitter? How are we seeing the actual Senate is trying to speak to Sam Bankman-Fried himself?
You know, we're seeing everyone is using Twitter. We see Maxine Waters from the House Financial Services Committee is increasingly used that to put pressure on Sam to testify. We've also seen Senator Toomey came out with his own tweet today that said, Sam, if you do show up at the House committee's hearing, you better show up at our hearing the next day. You know, everyone's using social media.
It's kind of painful. I mean, I think, CZ put in best himself, is like, no, I can't watch movies. They're not exciting enough. I'm just addicted to crypto Twitter. And aren't we all? And Shanali Basak is key among them. Just talk to us about not only what you're going to be following through Twitter, but what you're going to be following, Shanali, on the ground, because you're going to be there. You're going to be expecting testimony from who? And are they the right kind of people to be giving testimony?
That's an interesting question, because there are a lot of academics that are being called upon the House and the Senate hearings. Remember, there's only one set of small witnesses posted on the Senate committee site. Senate. We don't have everything from the House itself at all yet. And remember, Sam Bankman-Fried said he's willing to testify. Will he show up and testify? There was no subpoena up till this point as well. So a lot of questions about whether he'll be there in person. Remember, he does say that what he is trying to do is address not only FTX and the pathway to return value to shareholders, but also what led to the crash. We'll be looking at what he says versus what he has said before, as well as he says his own failings. He also said he doesn't have access to much of his own data, personal or professional. So you have to wonder why he doesn't have that access and what kind of data he will not be able to allegedly provide to the lawmakers as they question him if he makes it there to the Hill next week. So again, the House on Tuesday, the Senate on Wednesday, and remember, the senators have also been seeking to try to get them there as well, but they did not reply to them in time for the testimony so far. So logistically, let's see if he makes it to both.
Team Shanali has just gone to the exact point that I want to bring up. In fact, super producers, let's bring his tweet back up again and look at what he said. Because what I'm not understanding, Alison, is what would we learn from SBF on Capitol Hill that we haven't already learned in the many, 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 many appearances and communications that he's made in the last 7 to 10 days?
That's a great question. And I honestly, I feel like we're probably going to hear a lot of the same things. You know, he'll say that he didn't intentionally mean to commit any sort of fraud. He'll probably talk about the fact that maybe he made some managerial mistakes. So I'm sort of expecting it to be along the same lines. I'm actually maybe more interested in hearing the testimony of John J. Ray, who is the current CEO, kind of helping with the restructuring of FTX. You know, he has access to all of this data. He's sifting through these records, though he's told us that they're not very good. So I'm hoping that maybe we get some extra details from what we've seen in the bankruptcy filing so far.
Actually, Shanali, new headlines actually continue to come through about this story. I saw a tweet or a thread of tweets from the editor-at-large of The Block. Could you tell us what the story is there, please?
Yeah, you are referring to the tweet thread by Frank Chaparro, otherwise known as FinTech Frank, who 4 days ago released an almost two-hour podcast speaking with SBF about what had happened here. But really what had happened is he said he did not know, and many employees at The Block did not know and felt really put in the dark here, because what happened was an executive, the CEO of The Block, which is supposed to be an independent news site related to crypto that was bought out by management about a year or so ago. Yeah, absolutely got it. Look at that tweet right there. So what they are finding out now is that CEO had taken personal loans through a entity here that did not disclose that SBF had given loans to the CEO that ended up being part of what helped that executive lead to the buyout. So listen, the CEO has stepped down. You are seeing the employees reeling from this. They are saying they did not know at all. This was really found out within the past couple of days. And as I was saying, just 2 days ago, they had interviewed SBF himself.
I know it can, I mean, it can seem like inside baseball when journalists are talking about other journalists, but your heart does have to go out to people who feel completely undone, not only by their sector collapsing, the industry that they've grown to love collapsing, but then their own CEO seemingly catching them completely off guard and blindsiding them. I'm sure there's more to come from that. But overall, Alison, the transparency we're going to get from a regulatory perspective, from a lawmaker's perspective, and I asked it to Shanali earlier, I ask it to you now, the people that they're going to have in front of them giving evidence. I've seen some talk on Twitter again that people who feel very legitimate in this space haven't been asked, and some people who have been asked to speak perhaps aren't deemed so legitimate. Just talk to us about who we expect to hear from.
So on the House side, the only person that's actually listed as a witness so far is John J. Ray, so the current CEO of FTX. On the Senate side, we have a pretty small list as well. One of them is a law professor who specializes in sort of financial regulation and new technologies. And then the other one is Ben McKenzie. So if you watched The OC, then you would recognize that name. He was Ryan on The OC. He's more recently come out as a very anti-crypto skeptic and sort of crypto commentator. But a lot of people were a little surprised to see that name on the list.
Team OC. I think we all better get some rest this weekend. Next week,
a crypto
a big
never
week.
Sleeps, Ed. Crypto never sleeps.
Well, thank goodness that I do sleep Friday night through Sunday night. All right, Bloomberg's Alison Verspro and Shanali Basak, thank you both. Coming up, Huawei expands on the patent monetizing game. We'll discuss that and much more with top executives from the company next. This is Bloomberg.
We want to talk about another key story, particularly from a geopolitical perspective. Huawei Technologies has agreed to license some of its smartphone technologies, well, to an old rival called Oppo, one of China's top smartphone brands. Now, Huawei is one of the biggest holders of 5G patents, and many patents, in fact, and it's historically not been that aggressive in monetizing those patents. But the telecom giant now seeing itself perhaps in a need to look in revenues in other areas after its lucrative handset business was hit pretty hard by US trade sanctions that cut it off in terms of access to advanced chips. I'm very pleased to welcome, therefore, to the show, Huawei Chief Security Officer Andy Purdy, alongside Huawei's Chief Intellectual Property Counsel for the United States, Stephen Geisler. Thank you very much indeed, gentlemen, for both being here. And let's start first and foremost where we're thinking about the new areas of revenue. And Stephen, I address this question to you because how important now is the monetization of patents? How are you seeing this driving in terms of percentage-wise of revenue going forward?
So the revenue we will realize through patent licensing is not going to make up for or be in lieu of product sales. In any given year, we're talking about numbers that are in the hundreds of millions versus product sales, products and services combined being in tens of billions of US dollars. So certainly one is not going to be a replacement for the other. We are simply trying to make sure that based upon the money we've spent through the years on R&D and then patenting, that we are getting a fair return on our patent expenditures for patenting our technologies. And also using the patents to reach agreements with our competitors and peers to make sure that the innovation that goes into global standards, such as 4G and 5G telephony for Wi-Fi, for the audio video codecs that allow for streaming for your viewers to watch even today's show, that is recuperated by not only Huawei, but other large members of the ICT industry for what we spend on R&D.
I want to bring Andy Purdy, Huawei's Chief Security Officer, into the conversation. Andy, how much of a bitter pill to swallow is this for Huawei? You know, you once had a significant handset business that was a driver of revenue growth, but also just accounted for a big chunk of revenue. Now you are pivoting, essentially. Again, is it a bitter pill to swallow?
Well, we deal with reality. And the reality is that we have certain challenges. Our survival is first and foremost. Our ability to work with partners and customers to innovate and bring 5G-enabled technologies to the world is what we're about, to help bring connectivity to the world. And so that's the way we look at it. We've got tremendous opportunities out there. The international regime that Steve was just talking about, the idea that there are certain standards and certain companies may own patents relative to that standards, this international system of making sure there's fairness, that competitors can buy licenses from other competitors, is a huge thing on the international stage to help increase innovation and increase competition around the world. It's a great tribute to how well a global system works in the IP area.
Andy, though, those words, it's about survival. Just how threatened has your business model become through US-China tensions, and how non-ending do you think that this shutdown will be, this access to the United States, this ability to sell into it?
Well, when you look at our revenues from 2020 to 2021, our revenues dropped about $30 billion, mostly because of our inability to buy chips for our 5G phones. And so we are emphasizing tremendous investment this past year in R&D, over $20 billion in R&D, and thousands of partnerships to help bring 5G digital transformation to different industries such as smart mining and smart ports, and the ability to create safer environments and reduce energy consumption. And basically, we are finding our way in the world, and we're even doing hardcore scientific research on things like Moore's Law and Shannon's Limit, so that the scientific challenges of 5G, 5.5G, and 6G can be overcome for the benefit of the world. So we take the world as we see it, and we're working hard and innovating. I think we at Huawei are really proud of how we're moving forward with partners around the world.
Stephen, you're the U.S. Chief Intellectual Property Council. Oppo is still a Chinese maker of handsets. Could you talk us through how the deal came about and how difficult the deal was to get done?
Certainly. The deal was done through bilateral negotiations without the need for litigation. That's important because many times these deals are only brought about through litigation because we need the intervention of courts to help decide things such as what is the proper rate and what products are should be subject to a license agreement. Here that was not necessary. We also view that this is a key step forward. It's not our first Chinese cross-license by any means, nor is it Oppo's, but it is a major sign that the Chinese regime for patent protection continues to mature. These are two large competitors bringing about a very important agreement between the two of us.
Andy, I asked you earlier if having to license your tech rather than selling handsets is a bitter pill to swallow, and you said it's the reality. Where we are now, what is the reality of Huawei being able to sell not just handsets in terms of smartphones, but other hardware into the United States directly? How does that come about?
Our emphasis for the foreseeable future is in those parts of the world, and there are many, that are open to working with us, open to partnering from us. And so there are tremendous opportunities around the world. And so that's what we're focusing on right now. And frankly, as those of us in the United States, we look at some of the things we're doing around the world to help bring connectivity to the underconnected. We hope that in the United States, there can be a little more action and a little less talk about connecting the rural America in a resilient way and, frankly, helping to connect and have appropriate devices for distressed communities, poor communities in urban areas of the country. Americans really need to get the benefit of connectivity.
And overall, is that argument landing, Andy? Who are you speaking to here in the United States? Are people, do they still want in any way to grant access directly or indirectly for your technology? Do they feel the need for it? Because I was amazed to see just how many patents you put into the United States, for example, per year, like you're number one.
Well, as I said, our focus is not to do business in the United States. And as we talk about the lessons we are learning and 5G transformation around the world, it's not to enable us to do business. We think there are lessons that we're learning. We think there are lessons that the United States can learn from success stories in other parts of the world. Mm-hmm. I mentioned the smart mining and smart ports, but healthcare, manufacturing efficiency, reducing energy consumption in telecommunications. The United States needs to step up and be much more active in these things to help the competitiveness of the United States and help the American people.
I'm interested, Stephen, and I'm wondering if you can take us in the money direction in your focus as Chief Intellectual Property Counsel. You are not only just announcing, of course, the deal with Oppo, but you made public for the first time that you're also doing licensing 5G to Samsung. How much with some of these partners, particularly when it comes to Samsung, to Apple, to the huge players in this space, how much are you charging them in terms of patent use? And are you thinking about royalties in a different way? You're going to have to change the maths and be more aggressive.
Well, so first, we don't view ourselves as aggressive. We are certainly active in the licensing space. Where third parties have done independent studies of our licensing, our rates for our patents versus many of our competitors, we actually are much more in the middle of the pack. So we are not looking to set the highest rates in any industry or technology. The importance of U.S. patents, for instance, which you've mentioned previously, is still important, regardless of whether we ever sell a product again in the United States. Our patents, our technologies, are being used by U.S. companies. Many of those companies have freely, without litigation, have joined into license agreements with Huawei to pay for the rights to use our patented technology in the United States. No one in the United States can use Wi-Fi, particularly the new Wi-Fi 6, which is the AX version, without using Huawei's technology. Same thing with 4G, 5G. we are licensing car manufacturers and their suppliers all around the world, from Japan to China to the UK to Germany to the United States, on their use of our 4G technology in connected cars. And so that is the important thing, is making sure people understand the difference between global use of standardized technology, which Huawei is a leader in providing that technology, versus product sales.
Okay, Huawei Chief Security Officer Andy Purdy and Chief Intellectual Property Counsel for the US, Stephen Geisler, thank you both. And concerns linger that some of the biggest Chinese tech firms will be delisted in the US. As of Wednesday, about 81% of JD.com shares were circulating in Hong Kong's settlement system. This as investors move to convert them from US exchanges. That's a near doubling from the end of 2021, according to Bloomberg calculations. Similarly, Alibaba's Hong Kong-listed share portion rose 11 percentage points during the same period, a steady shift into Asia, which shows traders are continuing to hedge risks associated with the US-China spat. Now coming up, everyone's doing it. Are you? Lensa AI. It's the latest AI application, you've got to take my word for it, that makes your selfies look even better. Caroline and I, well, I don't want to give it too much away. Just wait and see. All that next. This is Bloomberg. So that's us, that's Caroline right there, that's supposedly me using the Lensa AI app, an all-in-one image editing app for your selfies.
Yours are really good. You look really hot. You look really smart. Does this remotely look like me? Not in the slightest. I'm kind of a bit depressed that...
I mean, I've just morphed into sort of an artistic Italian gentleman.
I've morphed into someone I really don't recognise, but they're kind of hot.
It was an interesting experience. Like, a lot of my photos were rejected, but... We're back, the real you and I. Hello.
Can we just... There's one photo where I look so unwell and miserable and completely unlike myself that I was kind of a bit depressed by it, but probably, as I kept saying, it sort of felt like my insides after all the holiday parties. But I am interested, Ed, that some people out there, right, one particular noted economist, thinks this sort of AI, particularly the ChatGPT, for example, is great strides in technology, right?
I mean, is this the best thing since sliced bread? Is this a game changer, revolutionary? As far as I can tell, it's just strange pictures of you and I. But
you've got to see our Twitter
I enjoyed
poll
the experience.
On it. Yeah, they've got to see our Twitter poll on it. Larry Summers says this will change us in terms of it's going to be as important as the wheel and fire. Seemingly, actually, most think it is revolutionary. This is Bloomberg.
It's not like there's an incredible amount of money that's ready to be deployed. I think the pace of investments in the venture ecosystem was masked a bit by capital that was coming from non-traditional ventures and corporate balance sheets. And so I think today what you're gonna see is a shift, probably not in terms of opportunity sets, in terms of how fast money gets deployed to the ecosystem, but I think you're gonna see people look for complete different dynamics within the balance sheets and the capital structures and the management teams that they're investing in.
That was PitchBook's Director of Research, Nizar Tahuni, giving his take on the current dynamics at play in the world of VC. Let's get someone else's take. Dina Shakir is with us now, General Partner at Lux Capital, a firm focusing on investments in emerging technologies, $4 billion in assets under management. It's been a week. It's been a big week for markets, for the world, economics. Caro and I have been talking a lot about data. You know, there was various data sets, but the big takeaway is that whether you do it on a volume basis, deal count basis, dollar value basis, 2022 is nothing compared to 2021 in your world. Why?
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me. I was expecting my Lensa avatar to show up instead of myself, but delighted to be here. So no denying 2022 was a roller coaster, and I think we're still in for a long ride with 2023 ahead of us. Many would say the exuberance of 2021 needed a correction, and that came with a bit of a jarring surprise to some, but also met the expectations of others. It was, in many ways, a long time coming. But I still think we're just at the precipice of understanding what the impact will be on valuations. across stages. And certainly for us, it's an area where we think there's a real exciting opportunity to continue being bullish on long-term opportunities.
I am going to let Caroline have all the fun, and I'm going to ask you a slightly dull question about economics, if you'd allow me to.
Sure. It's never dull, Ed.
Well, I know it's important. The funny thing is that if you're a I'm assuming if you're a venture capitalist, you assess a broad range of data just as a public market analyst would or investor. Inflation and the Fed, you know, every day for us, inflation and the Fed.
Yep.
What does it mean to you at this stage in the cycle?
Well, you know, we're VC, so we're long-term investors. We're not day traders. Obviously, there's no denying the impact of the macro on the micro, and we've seen that very clearly in terms of the opportunities for exits for venture-backed companies. But when we're investing in deep technologies, companies that we believe are market makers, we have to look with a longer perspective. And so, you know, 2023 does not look particularly promising, although none of us are Nostradamus, but we're looking ahead 5 to 10 years from now. And those opportunities are very exciting to be investing in the early days.
Dina, you've just made General Partner. Congratulations. And you focus a lot in the health space in particular, very much focused on female-focused businesses too. What is that more recession-proof than other areas? Healthcare many have turned to in the public market saying, look, this is one to be investing into at the moment with higher interest rates and with a slower growth prospect. What do you see in terms of the smaller, now growing industries?
Absolutely. I mean, I've often said that health and digital health is recession-proof. Now, that's not to say that it's immune to the macro conditions. That's definitely not the case. In any look at the public markets, no matter how well they're faring, you know, respectively, it's very clear that they're not. That being said, people will continue to get sick. They will continue to have babies. We will continue to have needs for therapeutics and for intervention and care, perhaps more so in the future even than we do today. And I think as a result, what we're seeing is really expanded interest and also a bit of a slightly better opportunity than you're seeing, certainly not just on the public side. You know, PitchBook, I think just yesterday published a report showing that the median deal valuations for venture-backed healthcare companies is actually up 33% year over year, which is a really interesting take vis-a-vis where the rest of the market seemed to be sitting. You know, one of our companies was on your show just a few weeks ago for their Series E, and that was a really exciting one in women's health where there's a lot of continued interest.
Yeah, shout out to Maven Clinic, and we were so pleased to be able to start the new show with Ed and I with Kate joining the show in that respect to bring us that Series E. But I'm going to ask a sensitive question now, Dina, and I know because you don't want to shy away from these sorts of things. Lux Capital, of course, has been embroiled in the FTX situation. You wrote checks, not you personally, of course, and you're not, therefore I'm not going to ask you about your own due diligence in the space, but what do you think internally the lessons you've learned are when you're looking at writing checks in a more difficult environment that we currently are? How are you looking for companies to be building their corporate governance, to be ensuring that they're giving you all the accounts that you need and the growth story is really there?
You know, I think this is something that's not necessarily just unique to that situation. There are other cases across healthcare in the recent months and years that have also really put a lens on the importance of due diligence. And so there's no doubt that that continues to be very important across the board. And I think perhaps some of the slowdown that we're anticipating in terms of the exuberance of 2021 vis-a-vis what we're expecting in 2023 will give all investors more time and more space to be able to do that, which, you know, is certainly a positive thing.
Dina, come back in the new year. Tell us how that 2023 is starting to unfold for you. Dina Shoka, we love having her on. Thank you, General Partner over at Lux Capital. Wishing you happy holidays. We don't get to chat before. Meanwhile, let's talk exits now, because we were just going there with Ed, and as some are still happening in the global startup space. In fact, let's go global, because Istanbul-based quick commerce platform, that's Getir, just bought its rival, Gorillas Technologies, in a deal that was valued at $1.2 billion, according to sources. Now, it marks the increasing consolidation in what we all thought at one point was an absolutely booming industry. You couldn't move for quick deliveries, but Gorillas raised funds valuing the company at about $3 billion before and had been exploring its options after investors just became so much more cautious over the industry's path to profitability. I mean, Ed, we were all talking about how quickly one could order their various groceries and they'd be coming within 20 minutes or so, but it just became ever more evident that these companies were not going to be able to head to profitability with this many players in the space.
So there's a fantastic quote in the story from the founder of the company saying, markets go up and go down, but consumers love our service. Convenience is here to stay. You know, whether that's true or not, we don't yet know. You know, the proof's in the pudding. But, you know, it's holiday season. I go to a lot of drinks with VCs, and, you know, they do say it's a case-by-case basis. There are some fantastic startups that are born out of recession, that grow out of recession, and there's opportunity right now if you can pick them out.
Yeah, and I think that this is what's going to be interesting. Where are the exits being made? Are you doing exits from acquisition, one private company to a private company? Or, Ed, are you still managing to get to the public market?
If that dreaded word, well, dreaded's not fair, but SPAC. Interesting. So let's get more from another guest, Sam Zayed, CEO of GetAround, which just went public on the New York Stock Exchange, or listed its shares. GetAround is a company I know. You know, I've written about GetAround. We've reported about broadly this platform in which owners of vehicles can list their cars to be rented out. It's like Airbnb for cars, Sam. Why list via this mechanism?
I mean, for us, you know, we went public because, you know, we had great partners. We found committed capital that really allows us to execute on our business plan. And it was really about just continuing to create long-term value and to get out into the public markets and be able to have access to that, you know, the public markets directly. We felt it was the right thing for us in this particular circumstance, in this particular category.
What sort of, with the money coming in, what does that now create you in terms of space to build? Where are you able to now drive forward, get around, particularly at a time where more people might be incentivized to share their car, to get money in that way?
Yeah, I mean, it is that type of time. I mean, I think a lot of consumers are looking for options to make extra money, potentially, you know, drive extra income or offset costs. And we, you know, we just felt that, you know, the opportunity was right given what we see in the category and in the market and some of the trends with, you know, our partners and in more generally with the shift to more consumers, you know, moving towards mobility and continuing to shift that, those patterns of mobility, you know, we felt the time was right.
Hey, Sam, really quick, you're pipping your great rival Turo to the public markets. The reception, interesting. What do you make of that?
Yeah, look, I think there's no denying the macro is, it's just a challenging market environment, but we weren't really optimizing for that as much as optimizing for, you know, really giving fuel to the business in order to really execute on our plans. And so, you know, the way we think about that is really we want to continue to execute, create long-term value, and over time we think that, you know, the market will respond and start to, you know, value companies properly on fundamentals.
Sam, thanks for spending some time with us from the floor of the NYSE. Sam Zayed, CEO at GetAround. Meanwhile, coming up, we're going to talk much more about the ongoing fallout from the collapse of FTX. Lawmakers questioning officials over at Silvergate Capital. It's a small bank that's facing some big pain after its decision to really take on crypto clients. This is Bloomberg. Well, a pretty obscure smaller bank. And then it got into crypto. Silvergate Capital is what I'm talking about. It found its niche when it started providing banking services to some pretty major crypto clients, including, well, Sam Bankman-Fried's FTX and Alameda Research. Now it's, of course, facing scrutiny from regulators and lawmakers on the back of that decision. Joining us now on a great set of reporting, Bloomberg's banking reporter, Max Reyes. And Max, just talk to us about how Silvergate first of all got into servicing these sorts of clients.
Sure. First of all, thank you for having me. And I think it might be helpful to back up for a second, sort of explain sort of the value proposition here for a bank. For banks that aren't dealing with crypto, you know, they're not helping to exchange tokens or anything like that. They're literally just holding deposits for crypto customers and sending them, helping them to send them back and forth, right, between themselves. The value there is that you can bring these deposits onto your balance sheet and you do not have to pay out interest, right? So you essentially have a very affordable way to fund yourself. And that's sort of what drew a company like Silvergate into this. And other banks have done it as well. Customers Bancorp, Signature Bank, but obviously a few of them have had banking relationships with FTX and Alameda that has folks raising concerns. Short sellers are kind of dogpiling the stock.
Yeah.
And you have lawmakers who are asking questions, and it's a result of these relationships.
From your early reporting and digging around, just how exposed has Silvergate become? What sort of areas within the financial services they offered made it more difficult to extricate themselves now?
Yeah, I think the biggest level of exposure is just the deposits they held on their balance sheet. Silvergate has said that they did not lend to FTX. They made it very clear that their only relationship with FTX and related entities, including Alameda Research, the hedge fund, was a deposit relationship. And so if you have a deposit with Silvergate, you can send money to other clients who also have those deposits on a platform they call the SEN, the Silvergate Exchange Network. And what our reporting indicated was that customers had been directed to buy FTX to send money to Alameda Research. And that was to, in at least one case, a Silvergate bank account. And that has raised concerns and questions from lawmakers. Our reporting doesn't go any further in saying sort of how that tied into the kind of commingling of funds and so on that have been alleged when it comes to FTX and Alameda. But it does mean that Silvergate is part of these really difficult questions being raised by lawmakers,
yes,
by regulators, by investors. You know, how did no one spot this, right?
You raised a good point, Max, about the short interest on the stock in that it's publicly traded, right? It almost has its own rise and fall story. I was looking at my Bloomberg to the end of 2021 when the stock was above $200 a share. Now we're down at $21 a share. I mean, what was the investor anxiety here for Silvergate? It was just their exposure to the contagion.
So what would be helpful to do is to zoom out, right? Because around this time last year, we were talking about digital assets being at all-time highs, and that's when the stock hit $222, just about that period. But over the last year, we've had more events than just FTX. We've had the blow-up of the Terra Luna ecosystem, which in turn led to the collapse of Three Arrows Capital, the collapse of Celsius. So publicly traded stocks with exposure to crypto, that's Silvergate, that's other companies, that's, you know, names like MicroStrategy, which literally just hold Bitcoin on the balance sheet. All of those companies have taken a beating in the last year because of this anxiety, and just the blow up of FTX sort of accelerated and worsened that impact, I would say.
Max, what have Silvergate said about all of this very quickly?
Certainly. Silvergate's been pretty clear in saying that the controls that they had in place were sufficient, that they, again, had no sort of lending or any other kind of relationship, and that they were, in one statement to NBC, they described themselves as victims of SBF and his misleading practices the same way everyone else is. So the company has been pretty frank in denying any claims of wrongdoing, and it should be made clear that authorities have not alleged any wrongdoing. They haven't been accused of wrongdoing,
yes,
by authorities. It's just there are questions circling.
Yeah, thank you for your reporting. Bloomberg's Max Reyes there. Coming up, the world's most populous nation rapidly pulling back on its COVID zero policies. We'll tell you what this means for the health of people in China, but also, of course, the tech companies doing business there next. This is Bloomberg.
While Hong Kong has served as a blueprint for China's opening up from COVID, it's also a huge, huge cautionary tale. Now, when the Omicron variant swept through this modern city of 7.5 million earlier part of this year, the city's sophisticated healthcare system was simply overwhelmed. At one point, Hong Kong had the world's highest death rate due to COVID. There simply wasn't enough space to put all the patients or bodies. Some of the sick were put outside on gurneys as body bags with the deceased stacked up in some wards next to the infected living. Morgues, too, were inundated. Most of Hong Kong's nearly 11,000 total COVID deaths happened between February and April of this year. Like Hong Kong, China has a largely under-vaccinated elderly population, but on a much, much larger scale. And China, too, doesn't have the more sophisticated mRNA vaccinations available.
We have to remember that China has been protected the public for so long. There has been no herd immunity in China. So this is going to start. And this process is not going to be smooth. It will be quite difficult.
With the sudden dismantling of COVID restrictions, including mandatory PCR testing to enter public spaces, China is bracing for a surge in infections and deaths, more than 2 million fatalities by one estimate. Criticism of COVID zero is rapidly being replaced by concern that the rapid policy shift away from the all-out eradication of the virus is happening too fast, and that China is ill-prepared, like Hong Kong was back in March, for a health crisis of unseen proportions. Stephen Engel, Bloomberg News, Hong Kong.
I mean, clearly a very tough story to continue to have to talk about. We forget the health impacts, of course, the death impacts, Ed, but also we have to talk, as we do at Bloomberg time and time again, the economic impacts of all of this. And we want to thank our Asia chief correspondent, Stephen Engel, for that piece, because you've been doing some really thoughtful leadership in terms of what's happening for companies such as Tesla, companies that are desperate to get into China and then find, well, the demand is being eroded, but in some ways the supply too.
You know, we may have stopped tracking the virus in Europe and in North America day to day, but in China, you know, look how quickly have we gone from COVID impacting production or impacting the ability of tech companies like Tesla to carry out their business to now the impact on demand, right? And even though there's this reopening and easing of restrictions, there are lots of questions about that. The most recent report from Bloomberg, according to sources, they're actually going to shut down the assembly lines imminently in Shanghai, and then later in the Chinese New Year in January do the same. Some of that, according to sources, is for maintenance, upgrades, but there's still this question about demand. It's a really difficult situation, I suppose, to understand.
And how hard is that going to be to peel apart what is just the usual way of things during the beginning of January for China and what actually is the COVID impact here?
Well, usual things for the beginning part of January when you have the Chinese New Year and normal for Tesla to do maintenance. It's just that Tesla doesn't communicate and say, here's our plan. And so investors, if you look at the share price this week, have got a little nervous despite a positive end for the stock on Friday.
I have a feeling we'll be talking about both China, both Tesla, plenty more next week. But for today, Ed, that's it for this edition of Bloomberg Technology, hey?
Yeah, that does it. Don't forget to check out our podcast. You can find it on the Bloomberg Terminal, of course, on Apple, Spotify, and always on iHeartRadio. Big week, Caro. But that's it for us. This is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.